Looking for some new art inspired by the national parks? Then be sure to check out our online store, The Gaze Shop.
This season, as we explore the landscapes of Olympic National Park, Mount Rainier National Park, Carlsbad Cavern National Park, and Guadalupe Mountains National Park, we've got some new items and designs coming your way.
Introducing our Olympic National Park and Mount Rainier National Park posters. These 12 by 18 posters make a great addition to any home or office, or a great gift for any lover of the national parks, even if that national parks lover is you.
Whether it's art for your wall or a sticker for your water bottle, you're sure to find something that sparks your love of the outdoors. Visit shop.gazeatthenationalparks.com to bring some of the national parks home with you.
My name is Robbie. I grew up in this area and I have four gay moms. Each set weren't able to get married when I was younger, while everyone in my life essentially was like, oh yeah, they're married. Back in 2013, they officially tied the knot, and that was a really big point in my family's life and is a really big point of pride in my own life, being able to finally see my parents be able to get recognized and get the same rights as everyone else's parents in my life. And so every year, it's just been a great way of being able to celebrate that acceptance that my family has been able to see.
And what does Pride mean to you this year?
Well, obviously bigger than ever this year because of what's been going on nationally and in our own government, with there being so much hate all over the country. It's more important than ever to kind of celebrate what makes us different and to try and be as inclusive as possible and as accepting as possible, so that those that are suffering that hate elsewhere can kind of get a little bit of peace, hopefully.
Hello and welcome to Pride Mix here at Gaze at the National Parks, the podcast. June is LGBTQIA plus Pride Month, and during the month of June, our Trail Mix episodes are called Pride Mixes.
Pride Mix is a chance for us to dive deep into queer history and, in some cases, how queer history intersects with the national parks and the National Park Service's role as America's storyteller.
Pride is sometimes undefinable, and at the same time, pride has a multitude of definitions depending on the person and the season of life they are in, because pride is also ever evolving.
The last several years of history have come to show this evolution, as progress that the queer community has made has been stopgapped, set back, and legislated against at a dizzying pace.
But that does not make pride any less important. In fact, it underscores its importance, not just for those who are out and proud, but for those who may not have yet had the opportunity to be.
Each year, we have used our Pride Mix episodes as a way to explore how pride and the National Park Service intersect. And this year, Pride Mix is a two-part series.
Last year, we had the opportunity to interview queer individuals within the community and organizations whose work is having a direct impact on outdoor spaces, the national parks, and the LGBTQIA plus community.
One of those interviews last year was with Diana Rodriguez, one of the two founders and CEO of Pride Live.
This year, we were able to sit down and chat with both co-founders of Pride Live, Diana Rodriguez and Anne-Marie Gothard, the organization and the two individuals responsible for the creation of the Stonewall National Monument Visitor Center in New York City. And while being partners in business and nonprofit mission, they are also partners in life.
Since the opening of the Visitor Center during Pride 2024, a lot has shifted in the cultural landscape related to queer rights, but in regards to Pride, nothing has been stamped out. It has only continued to evolve.
A year after its opening, we were invited to join the team of the Stonewall National Monument Visitor Center in their tent at World Pride in Washington, D.C., to discuss how the work of the Visitor Center continues and why Pride is in some ways more important than ever.
This episode features our conversation with Anne-Marie Gothard, president of Pride Live and co-founder of the Stonewall National Monument Visitor Center.
So we're here at World Pride in Washington, D.C., sitting with Anne-Marie Gothard, who is the co-founder of Pride Live, the organization that's responsible for the Stonewall National Monument Visitor Center. So how are you doing? And how are you enjoying this World Pride here in D.C.?
Oh, I'm great. Thanks for having me. So far, good.
It's been great
interacting with the people who are stopping by our booth.
It's been a beautiful day here, and it's wonderful to see so many people out and about to really see this like incredible celebration of Pride. I have never been to a World Pride before, so this is my first time. Been to many other Prides, but this is a very kind of blown out version of what Pride is.
I agree. And it's interesting you say that, because at the Visitor Center, You know, we've had visitors from 74 countries. So every day we're interacting with people who come, you know, near and far. So it, being here today, it replicates that in a way. So it's really been fun to talk to people who have been from other countries to hear about their interpretation, what Pride means to them. It really supports what we're hearing, what we're seeing in the visitor center, and the need to just have a space, you know, that we created.
Bringing it to the visitor center, what has the last year of being open been like for both you and Diana?
Oh, so many mixed emotions. It's been a phenomenal experience. And we joke about, you know, when we first started the concept of a visitor center, I don't think we truly understood what that meant. We knew, you know, philosophically in terms of like the operations for it, but the impact that it's having, just the attention that you're getting and building it, you know, oh, hopefully people will come. We, you know, didn't anticipate how many people would come within the first year. So it's been rewarding. You know, we always say that the visitor center is an opportunity for us to give back. So many people helped us along our journey, you know, through both our professional and our personal life. And to be able to build visitor center and give it back and open the door to so many different people is just as our way, as I said, as a gift to give back. So this first year has been phenomenal. I think we've delivered on what we set out to do. And now looking forward, I guess, to the future and all the opportunities that we have. One last thing I would just say is I don't think we realize how grand of opportunities or the number of opportunities that we have at the Visitor Center.
I'm curious about if you could take us back to the initial conversations, the story of who engaged who, and when you both decided that, okay, we're the ones who can do this and want to do this and are going to sign up to do this, because it is a very special circumstance to have, obviously, the NPS's role as defined by the Department of the Interior and the National Park Service is that it is America's storyteller. Part of America's story is the cultural stories of the people who are here and all of the various communities, Stonewall being representative of the queer community and the fight for equality that we are still on and what it represented. And they very smartly said, well, we don't know how to create a visitor center. Let's partner with some people who do. So what was that journey like to those initial meetings? And when did you come to the conclusion that, okay, we're going to do this?
I'd say it probably started late 2015. So Diana's background is in development, fundraising, and she was contacted by the NPS Foundation to work with them to help really bring awareness and funding to support the designation. Once it was determined that Obama was going to designate the park, then they needed to kind of kick into gear and do some fundraising. So Diana was first approached for that and worked with them. And then at the designation in 2016, Valerie Jarrett kind of casually, you know, gave Diana an elbow and said, okay, now we need a visitor center because every national park has a visitor center. And, you know, Diana is one of those individuals that if you plant a seed, like, interesting, let's think about that. Didn't commit, but you know, I would say it was shortly thereafter she mentioned to me the conversation, and you know, we talked about it, and I 100% said, sure, let's do it. Didn't quite understand what that meant at the time, but it sounded great. You know, it needed to be done. We then had to determine, you know, is the space even available? And if it is, how do we go about getting the space, you know, leasing it? Do we buy it? You know, there was a whole litany of questions that we went through. And once we were able to start that process, COVID hit. So we tabled it because it wasn't an opportunity to reach out to people because we knew we were going to have to, you know, raise funding for it. And then as COVID went on and once was near the end of the of COVID period, we decided that we would re-engage and talk with the building management to see if, you know, it was available, what they'd be agreeable, what do we need to do. And when we were able to secure the lease, then I think that's when everything just changed. Google was our first founding partner that signed on. By having them on board, it opened the doors for others to then say, I want to be a part of it. And through that, then, you know, we started the build. I guess we did the groundbreaking in June 2022. And we still joke to this day because Diana put on the outside, right? Anytime there's like a new building coming, you have a sign that says coming soon. And she actually put the date, June 28th, 2024. I had suggested, why don't we put summer? Or why don't we just say coming soon or put a quarter? And she said, no, it's the 55th anniversary. We are going to hit that date. And bless her soul, she worked with the, you know, our project manager, the construction company, architects, engineers. They all knew that that date was solid and we weren't going to miss it.
And you didn't.
We did
we
not.
We were there on that day. And what an honor it was to be there and see the support from everyone. That was the day where everyone showed up and showed out, because it was the first time this was happening for our community in this way. That was an incredibly special day. What was it like getting to that day a year ago? That was an enormously grand, beautiful ceremony. I know no one will forget for their entire lives.
What's interesting is, I think because we were so wrapped in what we needed to do, neither of us really saw the program. So we had a movie night, you know, a few days later where we actually watched the whole show from beginning to end. And the impact, and I remember my mom saying to me, "You won't understand what you did for several months." And she was so correct. You know, it took us a while, I think, to realize, you know, not only just the concept of it, but then opening the doors, celebrating it, now operating it, really was something that, you know, I think we stepped back and we still can't believe that we did it. You know, we were real intentional about everything. Everything we've done, I would say we've been incredibly intentional. And even with the groundbreaking and the grand opening, you know, everyone that was there and that participated in one way has been supportive of Pride Live, has been supportive of us, whether it's, you know, directly or it's through their community, through their network. They all had something special to bring to the program and to bring to what we've done. So it was a celebration, we hope, for everyone who participated as well, because we wouldn't have opened if it wasn't for them. And that was the one thing we really wanted to do as a way, again, to give back to them and thank them for helping us with that achievement.
So obviously making that space what it is involved a lot of just architectural planning, engineering, all of that. But when it came to the curation, because Stonewall is such a pivotal moment in history for LGBTQ plus rights, like, what was that process like in paring everything down? I mean, because from that, so much has happened since then, obviously, and so much has happened, was happening prior to that, but that was sort of like this kind of this bellwether moment. So what was it like to really investigate Stonewall and then to kind of like see the branches as they moved out from it? And how did you have to encapsulate what you could without overreaching, I guess?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think one of the things that we knew at the beginning is that we are telling the story of an event that happened, right? Sort of like a point in time. We knew that we weren't going to be able to tell the entire history of LGBTQ history. We weren't able to do that because an event, an historic event, took place. That was really our focus. So I think once we really narrowed down kind of the scope of the content, it was then, how do we provide context? And that's the piece that I think I'm most proud about, is that we're giving people context to what the Stonewall National Monument's about, but also what the rebellion was about. So when you visit the visitor center and you look at, it's called the Stories of Stonewall, which is our permanent exhibit. It's written in chapters. We want people to understand, okay, there was the bar, then you have Greenwich Village, you know, then we have about, you know, the impact of music even, because music is so important in culture. And then we talk about the uprising itself, Mothers of Stars and the community, and then the legacy of Stonewall. So we were deliberate in kind of organizing it into chapters, because we also recognize we only had 200 words, maybe a little more than that, for each panel on this wall. So it started with lots of content, and then we would continue to cut down. But it wasn't, I would say, until we really engaged, and we work with a variety of historians as well on this project, but when we really engaged with Mark Siegel, who's a Stonewall pioneer, he helped provide that first-person account. He helped introduce us to other people who were there. And through their telling of the story, or telling of their experience, that helped, I think, for us to be able to present it more in a narrative storytelling way, as opposed to feel like you're walking into a museum. And I think that's one of the reasons why the exhibit is resonating so well with people, because they're learning about the history, but they're also hearing it through, you know, through the stories of people that were there that night during the rebellion in 69.
Y'all, it's Dusty and Mike with exciting news.
That's right. It's our episode finder. It's all about making finding our episodes even easier.
Want to find more episodes about hikes in Shenandoah? With over 10 episodes across two separate seasons, it would have involved a lot of scrolling and searching.
Now, with our episode finder, you can find all those episodes with a few easy clicks. That way, finding an episode on Yosemite from season 1 is just as easy as finding an episode on Zion, Yellowstone, and Haleakala. All all in separate seasons.
With over 275 episodes in 35 different national parks, our episode finder will add ease when finding out more about hikes in these spaces.
But it's not just about hikes by national park. We've categorized our entire library so you can find hikes by state, hikes by terrain, and hikes by difficulty.
And all of our Trail Mix episodes are there too, so you can easily find our science-based episodes, interviews, and more.
Planning a trip to Colorado and want to hear more about our adventures there? Want to grunt it out on some really tricky trails or learn more about glaciers, grasslands, and mountains?
Just click the link in our show notes or on our Instagram bio, and it pops right up. You can also head directly to our website and look for the episode finder at the top of the navigation bar.
Conquer one hike in one national park, one park at a time, with just a few clicks with our episode finder. Happy trails!
Annie, and I work for the Stonewall National Monument Visitor Center. I don't really know if I have like an official definition, but something that's been really hitting home to me this year. There's a quote that's been going around the internet, and I feel like this might sound corny, but it's pride is important, or like the reason why we have pride is because someone out there thinks they're better off dead. And I just like, when I read that this year, I was like, ugh, like, okay. Yeah. And I think it's just like working in the center and then with pride, it's just a constant reminder of like that the community is more important than anything else. Like regardless of what higher ups, government, whatever try and throw at you, the people who come together, that is what pride is. And that is what the most important thing is for anyone in this community. So I think that's what pride really is for me this year.
With Stonewall being this touch point and really focusing there, how now, especially with what's happened, especially in regards to NPS removing T and Q from their website and now just being LGB history, how does that kind of galvanize the mission of the visitor center, and what are you anticipating or hoping you can do as a space that's partnered but a separate entity to kind of ensure that that legacy is not lost, because that legacy is so important to Stonewall itself?
Well, fortunately, we are independently owned and operated, and because we receive no federal funding and run primarily on donations, we do not fall under the administration's executive order. So that allows us to tell the story, to be 100% inclusive. It gives us the freedom as well in terms of the exhibit space, the programming, the events that we host on site. So we, you know, originally even in our mission, both for the Visitor Center and Pride Live, is to be all inclusive. It's needed now more than ever, I think, because of the executive order. So being able to curate both the content and installations that represent, whether if it's through, you know, the written word or through our videos, you know, we have a theater there as well, and through some of the documentaries, we're able to deliver. We're also able to protect and preserve. And that is our core mission, is to protect and preserve and share Stonewall's legacy. And that's all encompassing. So the fact, again, that we are independently owned and operated gives us the freedom to do that. I think in a way that is authentic, but it's also in a way that allows us to reach all generations. And that's a really big piece I want to mention too, you know, in terms about when you're talking about the storytelling. It's great that we have, you know, the individuals that were there in 69, but what does it mean for future generations? How do they interpret Stonewall legacy? And I think that's one of the things that we do. We have two installations where it's curated by a partnership we have with the students at Parsons School of Design. And to see the students interpret, you know, how do they learn from history but make it relevant to what's going on in their world, has been amazing. And then to see visitors respond to that has been great. And so I think that is when you ask the question about where do you go from here, I think the next generation, they're in a way, they're kind of dictating and helping guide what that next is. But we also recognize there's a huge gap. They don't understand the history. And so by giving them sort of like, on, if you, you know, like joke, the West Wall is the historical side, it's the context. The East is the new generation, right? So where do the two merge? And that's what we're finding, you know, through the tour groups that we have with students of all ages, all the way up to associations who have groups that come in. They're getting input, what Stonewall means from today's generation. And today's generation is learning from the pioneers who really, you know, we're standing on their shoulders for the rights that we have today.
I love that. And to just sort of borrow from nature, it's sort of like the sun rises on the new generation and sets on everything that has come before it, like with like the East Wall and the West Wall, right? Like that's what it made me think of. And I was like, oh, I love that. Like the sun isn't setting on the new generation. It's starting with the new generation. And then, but all of the previous generations before are always there and they're protected and preserved here in this space. You mentioned like the evolution of the new generations coming forward. We in our, you know, in our lives have certainly seen an evolution in pride, what it means, what pride celebrations used to look like, even in our own lifetimes. You know, I remember I never even saw a pride celebration until I moved to the New York area in 05. Because I grew up in South Mississippi. I didn't even know about a pride celebration. I found out about Southern Decadence like a while ago, which is happens in New Orleans, but I never saw a celebration of pride until I was fully in my 20s. And they never had them in South Mississippi. I think they do now, which is huge, which is a big, big thing. And I'm curious, like, what's been your journey with pride and seeing its evolution, and what evolutions do you see on the horizon?
No, that's interesting. I never really stopped to think about that. And I would say I grew up in Michigan, in the suburbs of Detroit, and wasn't necessarily exposed to pride. In fact, we were the first black family in our neighborhood, and my parents had to sue to buy our house. And that was in 1971. So I would say my early years were probably dealing more with discrimination due to my race, and wasn't until I came to school and college. And that's probably when I was then more exposed and participated in pride and other related events. So I think it's interesting today that, because I was asked this question actually the other day by someone, and that, when you think of pride, I think it's the marches, it's the parades, it's the festivals. And underneath that, there is that, sort of historical content, but it's also about being authentic, right? Pride today, I think, is we are a community, and I want to be my authentic self, and no one's going to take that away. And just looking at the people who have stopped by the booth and having conversations, you really see that. Whether if it's in their dress or in their groups or you name it, it's about how can I bring my authentic self to every interaction. And it's interesting because again, growing up, topics about queer life wasn't on mainstream TV, wasn't written about. Now it's everywhere. So that also has, I think, a huge impact that, how do we reclaim what is our history in a way that, again, is true to us, is authentic, but allows for that self-expression.
How you see that reflected today here at World Pride? And like, World Pride was something that was celebrated in New York a few years ago. Now it is here in DC, particularly this year. What sort of like read of the energy are you getting here in this space today? And how is that connected to sort of your understanding of the evolution of pride?
Well, what we've seen, or what I've seen, and I've had conversations, you have, parents with their children, here's an opportunity to explain and let them see, again, the celebration and what it's all about. We also just recently had a friend of ours stop by who was with her father who served in Vietnam. They came up yesterday for the Veterans Parade, and he was just, he wants to learn. And that's the one thing that either at the visitor center or here at the booth, people just have questions, natural questions, and they want to learn. They want to be a part of it. They want to understand it. And I think if we can continue to gather in places, whether if it's at a festival or if it's at the visitor center, we're providing that foundation. We're providing that platform. It's also been really interesting just to see the span of generations who are stopping by, which is phenomenal. I had a gentleman who came by, and he was from Venezuela, and he started crying right here at the booth because he was there in the 60s. And he just said, this is so lovely what you're doing. And he goes, it just brought back all the emotions because people don't understand, the AIDS epidemic, the impact that it had in the community, and the fact that, the visitor center is dedicated, to Diana's uncle. She shared that story with you, but for him to just relive that, like he just literally, and I wasn't expecting to see tears today. We see it frequently in the visitor center, but for him to have that type of emotion, I think it just reinforces the need to have gatherings. And again, whether if it's in festivals, parades, or marches, but just to have those opportunities for interaction, we need them now more than ever.
Stonewall, in its own generational evolution, has always consistently been a gathering place. Always. I mean, like, something that Diana mentioned when we talked to her a year ago was, if something happens to our community, everyone gathers at Stonewall. If there's something to celebrate, everyone goes to Stonewall. If there's something to protest, everyone goes to Stonewall. And I'm curious about what, in the past year with the Visitor Center, how has the Visitor Center continued to, like, participate in that sort of other role that Stonewall plays as a gathering space just for community?
I would say we provide the context, right? Because people know something happened. They know this is where we go. But understanding the why behind it, we're able to fill that in. And one of the things that we've been noticing the last few months, because there's always walking tours, right? Christopher Street tours, or, you know, the National Park does tours, but we've become the starting point. So people come in, they read the stories, they read the panel, they get a grounding, they kind of leave with an emotional lift, and then they go out on the tour and they experience, they see it, and they walk the route that encompasses the Stonewall National Monument. So I think having a physical space, and it's interesting because when we, you know, going back to your original question about building it, it's a landmark building, so we knew externally we couldn't do anything, but we also knew that it's like sacred ground and that we were given something very special. And how can we pay tribute to the space yet keep it true as a visitor center? We didn't want to recreate the bar, you know, because people had suggested, well, why don't you make it like a bar? I'm like, no, a bar exists on the other side, which is great, but that's not what our mission is, and that's not our purpose. So we kept as much of the original interiors that we found through demolition, or at least tried to replicate it in that regard. And I think that's why it's so impactful, that when something happens, people know that this is a place where a group of people took a stand. They had had enough. They weren't going to put up with it anymore. And this is that place to pay, you know, as I said, sort of tribute to that, depending on whatever's going on in today's society. So that's why I think it remains sort of a rally point, because people recognize the history of what took place.
Oh, I'm so glad you didn't recreate that. As a museum nerd, I'm like, I'm so glad you did what you did, because, like, the bar is next door. I can go next door, and I mean, everybody can go next door and get the feel of what it was like that day, or what it was like in there at that time, you know, because it is a bar and it is a different vibe. And something I consistently love about Stonewall, the bar, is that it feels like a very intersectional queer space for all of the spectrums of queerness, which is not something I can say of every gay bar or queer bar. But it is something I feel like we can say of Stonewall, because that is the experience I see anytime I go in there. But now it's like, you can go get context and go to the bar, have a full experience with it.
And one of the things I used to do, when I enjoyed doing when we were going through the build out, is you would see families stand outside and the parents would explain to their children the significance of it. But they couldn't go in because you have to be 21 to go into a bar. Now what's happening is we see parents, especially if their kids are like teenage, but they're not yet drinking age, the parents will come into the visitor center, they'll have an experience, they'll send the kids over to the Starbucks so that they can go in into the bar and have a quick drink, which I think is, you know, pretty unique. But it's the best of both worlds, and it allows the family still to be together, but yet the, you know, the parents to have that special time in the bar.
I think it also speaks to carrying the torch forward and the idea of this intergenerational movement that's still going on, that's going to continue to go on, and this idea of feeling strengthened by the past, but like feeling hopeful about the future. I think for me, and I'm curious for you, I feel like that's about a lot of what Pride is about. It's like feeling that strength from the past and building upon that to build hope for what the future could be.
Yeah, so true. And we had one of our team members say one day, I've become a more optimistic person because every day I look at the wall that has all the stories about those who came before her. It was one of those things that was just kind of like, wow, you know. And to have someone who works there, and I would say everyone on our team, understands the mission, lives the mission, is passionate about it, but to know that just being there and, you know, seeing the stories every day can change someone's mindset is so strong.
My first name is Andrew. For me, Pride is something that I didn't know that I would be able to have growing up, coming from like a conservative family and things of that nature. Was able to see Pride as finding my family, finding my truth, being able to be who I am, and finding people who believe in the same thing through and through. And I think for me personally this year, it's really, really important with the current administration that we have, and a lot of the rhetoric, right? Pride. I'm coming from Texas, and you know, right there, like, we have so many things coming through the legislation that's targeting so many of my personal friends and family that I consider my family. And so this year, Pride specifically just means making space for us, the space that we deserve as humans living on this same planet. So to me, that's what Pride is.
And for more information about and to donate to the Stonewall National Monument Visitor Center, go to stonewallvisitorcenter.org. Looking for more episodes like the one you just heard? Then be sure to check out our episode finder for episodes by park, state, hiking difficulty, and terrain, as well as all of our Trail Mix episodes in one helpful place. Click the link in the show notes of this episode, our Instagram bio, or visit our website to make your listening experience even easier.
This has been Gaze at the National Parks, the podcast, and we're here to remind you to hike early and hike often, and that adventure is always out there.
Gaze at the National Parks was created, produced, edited, and hosted by us,
Justin Ballard
and Michael Ryan.
To see images from this episode, follow our Instagram at Gaze at the National Parks. To contact us, email us at gazeatthenationalparks@gmail.com. And to find out more about the parks visited on this show, visit our website, gazeatthenationalparks.com. That's Gaze, G-A-Z-E.
All original artwork featured on Instagram and on our website is by me, Michael Ryan.
All original music was written and performed by Dave Seaman and Mariella Klinger, with Sean Sklios on guitar. Our music producer is Skylar Fortgang.
We would also like to acknowledge that while recording this episode, that we were on the traditional and stolen lands of the Lenape people, also known as New Jersey.